Welcome to Soundbites, a series about the food we eat. We're going to spend the next year examining the entire system of how food gets to the farm to your table, including the history, politics, health, and environmental concerns, and the economics of wholesome food. You're already familiar with some of the issues. Our neighborhoods have become food deserts, with not a supermarket to be seen around us for miles. Our children are unhealthy, with type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure showing up at younger and younger ages. Many of us die too young from preventable diseases. We believe it doesn't have to be this way. Over the coming year, we're going to share stories about our food. We'll explore how farms, both urban and rural, can feed and employ our people, how we can get fresh produce to our citizens, how we can take care of the environment, and how we can create a 21st century food system that is more just and healthier for each of us and our world. We believe it can be done. Please join us as we explore how we get there together. This week on the show, we hear the latest food and ag news from Food and Water Watch's Patty Lavera. And then we'll hear from Mitch Jones, who will tell us about alternative ways of measuring our economy beyond the gross domestic product, or as we call it, the GDP. And we're about to talk about what's being called the Monsanto Rider that was passed as part of the 2013 continuing budget resolution, funding the government through September. Many folks say this is just a rider that means nothing. Others are saying that what it does is takes the right of people to challenge genetically modified seeds in court. But we'll talk about what all that means with our three guests. Steve Savage joins us once again. He's agricultural technology consultant and blogger at Applied Mythology. Colin O'Neill is director of government affairs for the Center for Food Safety. And Greg Jaffe is director of biotechnology for the Center for Science in the Public Interest. And gentlemen, welcome. Good to have all three of you with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And let's just start. This is, I guess, confusing for some folks who've read about it, though I think many people have not read about it at all. This rider that was put in the continuing resolution bill, some argue that what it does, let's see, how was this put by one of the newspapers? One of the papers wrote it up saying that that it strips the federal courts of their power to restrict the planting and sale of genetically modified seeds. In other words, saying that even if USDA wanted to complete an environmental impact assessment of a specific GMO crop, it wouldn't suffer from being planted, that it keeps going throughout a lawsuit or an investigation. So, Steve Savage, how do you read it?
Well, I sort of read it as the Farming System Protection Act. There have been lots of lawsuits filed and probably always will be, even after the regulatory process is complete. This is speaking really about just one particular part of the coordinated framework where USDA, FDA, and EPA each have their own sort of parts of the oversight of biotech crops that they do. And one of those things is the USDA point in the process where they sign off and say, we don't see any reason to, you know, that we need to keep regulating this crop. It's ready. It can become a commercial crop. But then that can be dragged into court, and it causes a lot of uncertainty in the seed market, planning decisions on the parts of growers, and this just happens over and over again. So that's why this was supported, very publicly by all the major ag grower sort of organizations back last summer.
Colin, your website and place has written a lot about this. I mean, what's your take on what this means?
Well, we really see this as a dangerous anti-justice provision.
What do you mean by that?
Essentially, this provision seeks to prevent the independent judiciary from doing its job. It not only goes over the head of the U.S. Department of Agriculture by forcing them to comply with industry-driven demands, but prevents the federal courts from safeguarding farmers and the environment when they rule that a crop was approved unlawfully.
So, okay, one of the things that in kind of trying to read through this and trying to make sense of it for myself and for our listeners, there are two things I want to look at. I mean, one, does this rider that was placed inside of the continuing resolution, which many people do. They put riders all over the place to get the bills that they want to see passed without major congressional discussion. It's not the first time this has happened. It happens all the time. But does it mean, in fact, that the USDA, United States Department of Agriculture, would be forced to permit the selling, growing of crops that are GMO crops, even if people are calling for them to be environmentally tested, even if there's a lawsuit to stop them? Does this kind of override that by saying that the companies can continue doing the work even while the testing is going on? Is that something new, or is that something not new, Colin O'Neill? That's what I'm trying to get. That's what I don't understand.
Yes, and the clarification is very important here. Federal courts, even the Supreme Court, have ruled that USDA can examine partial deregulations. In its 2010 ruling on Roundup Ready Alfalfa, the Supreme Court said that USDA should have considered as part of one of its options issuing a partial deregulation. With Roundup Ready Sugar Beets, USDA, in fact, did issue a partial deregulation to allow for planting in certain areas where harm would be minimal while it conducted a full environmental impact statement that was required by federal courts. The reason that this rider is different from the working mechanisms that USDA has in place is that there's the incorporation of one really important word, and that's shall. The USDA shall immediately approve either permits or partial deregulations when requested. As your speakers here have reiterated, the USDA already has working mechanisms in place to allow for these types of things. This handcuffs the agency just as much as it does federal courts, because it forces the agency to immediately approve those things.
So, from your other perspectives here, now, Greg, before we go back to Steve, that sounds like it does change what the USDA would be doing from what it did in the past. Because in the past, isn't it true that the USDA, if somebody was going to have a test to see what these GMOs were going to do, what the environmental impact might be, let's say, having that kind of assessment done, that would stop the planting of these crops until that was done?
It's not as if they haven't had that assessment. And in every case where this has worked its way through the court, it's always resulted in saying, all right, there's actually no problem. There is no harm. There's no disaster. There's nothing. I mean, we're like 17 years into the commercialization of this technology, and really there needs to be a statute of limitations on saying the sky is falling.
If I might jump in here,
Mr.
Jaffe. So, again, I read the whole provision. I look at the whole provision, and the last line says that nothing in this section shall be construed as limiting the Secretary's authority under the Plant Protection Act, Sections 1, that lists three sections, which is the ones we're talking about here. And so, Congress lots of times writes shall or writes certain deadlines on the executive branch, and those are not enforceable. And so the fact that they write shall, I guess, to me doesn't mean it's still not discretionary, especially with the language that says that it must protect the environment if it does any of these interim measures, and it can't violate its authority under the Plant Protection Act. So if, in fact, the genetic engineered crop was vacated by a court because the court said it was a plant pest, I don't think that USDA could issue temporary permits without ensuring that the plant that was the plants that were grown weren't plant pests. So, to me, again, I still see this as keeping pretty much what already exists out there, in the sense that the Secretary still doesn't have to do this. Now, there's a strong statement in there that this is what Congress wants to do, so there may be a lot of persuasion going on. But as a matter of law, if a court decided a GM crop was harmful to the environment or harmful to plant pests, nothing in this provision would require the Secretary to issue a temporary permit or a deregulation.
Colin?
This is Colin. And I would say that Greg raises a very interesting point, and that is the uncertainty. I think, and you raised, Mark, that this was put in a rider. It's, you know, business as usual. Riders are in must-pass bills all the time. That doesn't excuse this rider from being incorporated in it, absent consideration by the Agriculture Committee on the Senate side, by the Senate Judiciary Committee, you know, a number of folks, including the ACLU, National Farmers Union, are really concerned about this not only being an unprecedented attack on U.S. judicial review, but not, you know, removing the ability of federal courts to safeguard farmers and the environment. Is this still an open question in law, as it is very precedent-setting? For that reason, we felt that it was very dangerous for Congress to move forward with this rider thrown in the middle of the night, absent any type of review or even public transparency.
Colin, do you realize that this was intended and very publicly discussed as part of the fiscal year 2013 Agricultural Rural Development Food and Drug Administration Appropriation Act? That this definitely was, it happened to get slipped in here, and I don't even like the whole idea of riders, but it's not like this came out of the blue. This was a very publicly discussed thing, as I said, very widely supported by groups like the American Farm Bureau Federation, the American Seed Trade Association, the American Sugar Beet Growers Association, National Association of Wheat Growers. This whole in the middle of the night thing is just a false narrative.
Well, I would look at Senator Mikulski's statement that she issued on Friday, where she said that she opposes this rider and wasn't a part of it. You know, if the chairwoman of the Senate Appropriations Committee abdicates responsibility for this, you know, frankly, there was not enough discussion about the impact that this would have. I remember last summer's FY13 AgriProbes bill. At the same time, we raised these concerns that this is a backdoor corporate earmark, that there were no committee hearings in any of the relevant subcommittees or full committees with jurisdiction on this issue, and those concerns were never addressed. This is very different than merely a sense of the Senate saying that we feel that USDA has the existing authority to require partial deregulation. This is very certain in its intent, and the companies and sponsors behind this rider would like to make sure that this language stays in law. You know, if Congress feels that this law needs to be changed, PPA, you know, it should be done so in a transparent manner, as Greg points out, by holding hearings in committees with jurisdiction, soliciting expert testimony, and including the full opportunity for public debate on all sides of the spectrum. You know, I think certainly litigation is a symptom of a system not working. Time and time again, the USDA fails to adequately consider the impacts of GE crop approvals to conventional and organic farmers, as well as the environment. And consistently,
what would you actually cite as an example of an environmental problem that slips somehow through the?
It was Steve, okay. Right? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, what would you actually point to?
Well, federal courts have said that there are harms to conventional growers through contamination with Roundup Ready sugar beets. Courts found that Roundup Ready sugar beets could contaminate conventional beets as well as Swiss chard, and they requested and forced the agency to assess the impacts in their EIS.
But then how did it finally come out at the end?
Well, the USDA put forward an EIS that said that they didn't feel that there were enough impacts to require them to not approve Roundup Ready sugar beets.
Right, because every sugar beet that's ever been grown can cross-pollinate other sugar beets. This is not some new phenomenon. This is you use the word contamination, but what we're talking about here is cross-pollination. We're talking plant sex, right?
Well, it's contamination. I would say
it's only
contamination.
A contamination if someone decides to make it an issue. But growers have, for decades, for centuries, have known about the need to isolate seed production. You know, for you know, when you're trying to have a pure seed line, that this is something that people have handled quite well for a very long time.
Right. Well, and
Steve.
Go ahead, Colin.
Yeah, this is Greg Jaffe. Independent of the merits of whether or not there's an environmental harm or a harm to farmers here or not, the law is set up so that there are checks and balances, and the court should be allowed to make sure that any agency complies with the law. And if the law says that there's supposed to be an environmental assessment or environmental impact statement of what their activities are, and USDA doesn't do a good job on that, they should be called to do a good job on that.
Except that, show me an example where USDA didn't do a good job.
I think both the alfalfa case and the sugar beet case, despite the fact that I think they made
the right, they made the right decision on deregulation, that it didn't cause a plant pest harm. But I think the courts were right in both those instances in slapping the hand of USDA and saying, USDA, you really didn't do the thorough job you needed to do on the environmental impact statement regarding the National Environmental Policy Act. Now, that's a procedural statute, so they didn't follow the procedures. And they were slapped on the wrist, and they had to go back and follow the procedures. After they followed them, that statute doesn't change substantively whether one can grow the Jenkins-Ear sugar beets. But the whole point of that statute is just to ensure that the government knows and the public knows what are the environmental impacts of their actions. It doesn't put value judgments on whether those environmental impacts are too great to stop the action from going forward or not. That Congress needs to give other authority to court, to agencies to deal with that. But I am a firm believer in the government and the public understanding what potential environmental impacts there might be.
Right, but this isn't saying that people can't bring those lawsuits and that those can't be worked through. It's just saying, in the meantime, when it's clearly being done as an obstructionist effort on the part of people filing the lawsuit, in the meantime, let's let the farmers, you know, have some predictability in their seed market.
Colin, you're trying to jump in as well. Go ahead.
Sure. You know, and I think going back to the point that Steve's raised about cross-pollination and contamination, a good distinction is contamination occurs when a farmer loses their export market because their crop was contaminated by a crop that, say, isn't approved in foreign markets. This has been a risk, and this is a risk that federal courts have recognized. It's misleading to say that cross-pollination has been happening for 10,000 years. That's true. In the history of agriculture, crops cross-pollinate, but it's only since the onset of biotechnology that farmers have risked their livelihoods being lost when their crops are contaminated by a genetically engineered
virus. Do you have examples where that has happened?
Well, I would point to Liberty Link rice. Farmers in America lost $1 billion because of a Liberty Link rice contamination episode. Japan blocked the export or the import of U.S. rice as a result of that contamination episode. And here's a case that we would have with this rider in place, a federal court striking an approval of a crop in the U.S. So it's an unapproved crop in the U.S. that's grown through this backdoor statute that then could contaminate markets which have not approved that event. So you've got an unapproved crop being grown in the U.S., sold to a market that crop was unapproved as well. There could be severe market loss. This is an example of why the Senate Ag Committee should have been brought in to part of this discussion. You know, these are open-ended questions that need to be explored before something like this is put out rather than after.
But isn't it also likely that the it was an irrational response on the part of the foreign country? I mean, there is a worldwide scientific consensus that there is nothing inherently more risky about breeding crops with biotechnology. That's the opinion held by scientists everywhere. So we unfortunately live in a world that is highly irrational, but you know, does that mean that we should just let irrational things run everything?
Steve, I'll let you ask the EU or Japan or any other countries about their own restrictions that they put in place. They have mechanisms to allow the import of foods that they deem safe or acceptable. Monsanto, Dow, DuPont, you know, all these companies are seeking approval for their crops in foreign markets. That's not up to the USDA or Congress to force other countries to acquiesce to our system, which is obviously severely broken.
So in the final analysis here, before we have to go, so if this, with this rider, that will it fundamentally change the way things are done now? Does it give does it give farmers less power over their land and seeds, or does it give companies that create GM seeds and crops greater power to push their product? I mean, does it change the dynamic at all, or is it the same battleground we had before?
Again, if you look at it, farmers are in very much in support of this, and farmers are actually very much in support of biotech crops. When biotech sugar beets finally came out, they went to like 95% adoption in the first year. That's because it provided something of value to those growers. So it, the growers are much more concerned about the endless litigation than they are about the technology.
Colin, and then Greg. And
federal courts have always recognized and tried to safeguard all farmers in the environment when considering these issues. That means biotech growers as the same as conventional growers, as the same as organic growers. Just because some special interests have more power on Capitol Hill doesn't that mean that organic and conventional growers should risk contamination, and or at the same time that environmental impacts like increased pesticide use and the proliferation of superweeds shouldn't be examined. But moreover, this is an unprecedented attack on U.S. judicial review. You know, at its face value, it's either unnecessary, or extremely bad policy. And we're disappointed that the Senate appropriators were willing to allow such a dangerous policy rider to be included when it wasn't included in the recent House passed CR.
And Greg Jaffe, final thought.
I guess I would say that I think this is unnecessary. I don't think it is good policy. I don't think that it really changes either the power of courts or the power of USDA. I think it reiterates things that already existed. But I would add that, you know, the real solution to all this is for USDA to do a good job at the beginning. If they properly assess the environmental risks of these crops and properly ensure that they're not plant pests, then any decision that they would make would be validated by the court, and there would be no need for any provision like this to even come into play. And I think that's what, in the end, is the best policy forward.
I want to thank you all. Greg Jaffe, who's director of Biotechnology for the Center for Science and the Public Interest. Colin O'Neill, before that, director of Government Affairs for the Center for Food Safety. And Steve Savage, agricultural technology consultant and blogger at Applied Mythology. Gentlemen, thank you so much. We're about to have a conversation with Patty Lavera, who is the assistant director of Food and Water Watch, where she coordinates their food team, which is just perfect. So we're going to talk about food. And Patty, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what's going on out there in this wild and wonderful world of food and production? What's at the top of your list?
Well, a lot of folks recently, I think, heard about some kind of shenanigans that went on when the federal government, Congress, had to pass a kind of a short-term budget extension to keep the federal government from shutting down, and that's the budgets for all of these agencies. And so in the budget for the USDA, there were actually two pieces that we were not happy with. One of them got a lot of attention because it basically took the federal courts out of the equation when you're talking about how genetically engineered crops get approved. And then the other piece that was in there prevents the USDA from enforcing some rules about how poultry companies deal with their contract growers. Those were both kind of bad riders that were in this budget bill.
Now, we talked about the Monsanto rider earlier in the program, but what was the poultry portion of this bill? What was that?
So, you know, folks that have been, and, you know, folks like Food and Water Watch and a lot of family farm groups for years have been trying to get the USDA, and there's a particular branch inside the USDA called GPSA, trying to get them to, you know, enforce basically antitrust laws. And in the last farm bill in 2008, we got some rules put in there that USDA had to update what's allowed and what's not allowed when meat packers and poultry companies contract and buy animals from farmers. And so it was a long fight. USDA proposed some rules, and the meat industry managed to kill most of them. But the little bit that survived were protections in how they write contracts for poultry growers. So the USDA has been supposedly enforcing those rules, and, you know, poultry growers could say, hey, you know, they did this to me in my contract, this isn't allowed. It was supposed to really kind of stop the worst abuses. So what happened, unfortunately, in this this budget bill that just got signed into law last week is it stops USDA from enforcing those little bits that were left on the contract rules.
And who and what will that affect the most?
So, you know, on the poultry side of things, it takes away some protections for contract growers. So,
for the contract growers themselves.
Yeah. And so they, you know, they're called contract growers because they're working on a contract with a big company like Purdue or like Tyson. And so, you know, they have a contract. Usually it's for one flock of birds. And these rules that USDA was enforcing basically set some parameters of just some really explicit parameters of things you can't do about suspending the delivery of the next batch of birds and things like that, and how the companies have to treat these growers. growers. And so, you know, this was slipped into a budget bill. This is the kind of shenanigans that go on when they don't want to, you know, hold this stuff up in the light of day. And, you know, it told USDA not to enforce those rules for now.
Now, it's always interesting to watch, talking about shenanigans, what happens inside of the National Organic Standards Board. And it's this whole battle of organic anyway and how we define it. And a new battle is brewing with the people who are on one side trying to say organic is purer than this, another saying, no, it means many broader things when they're talking about antibiotics and fruit trees. What is that about? I didn't know
that
apples catch cold.
They don't catch cold, but the trees, the apples and pears, and they catch a disease called fire blight. And it's no joke for these growers. You know, we acknowledge that. That's a disease that the tree happens to the orchard. The trees don't produce very well. It can kill the tree. And so this is a challenge in all of agriculture. You're dealing with pests. You're dealing with disease. But organic is, you know, certified organic runs by a very specific set of standards. You can do this. You can't do that. And a lot of what organic is setting the rules about is about materials. You know, what can you use? You can use this substance. You can't use that substance. So folks who are, you know, used to organic are probably thinking, wait, I thought they didn't use antibiotics because organic livestock, you know, dairy cows, chickens, they cannot be given antibiotics. That's one of the distinctions between organic and conventional. But there's been a loophole, basically, for fruit tree growers that if they had this fire blight disease, they could use certain antibiotics. One of them is tetracycline to treat it. And so that decision, that loophole, you know, they had it for 5 years. That's coming up for expiration. And so there's a board that votes on what the organic standard should be. They meet twice a year, and they're meeting in early April. And they're going to vote on whether to allow the use of tetracycline for a little bit longer. And it's going to be a big, heated debate at this meeting.
Patty LaVere, we appreciate the time you always take with us, and we look forward to kind of a continuing segment with you about what's new in news, what's new in food news. Patty also joins us for other conversations that are much longer and in debate, as well as conversation. She's Assistant Director of Food and Water Watch, where she coordinates the food team. And Patty LaVere, once again, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a very brief break right now, but don't go away. When we come back, we'll hear from Mitch Jones, also with Food and Water Watch, about alternative ways of measuring the economy beyond gross domestic product that we call GDP. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome, everybody, to another segment here on Soundbites. We are about to have a conversation with Mitch Jones. Mitch Jones is director of the Common Resources Program at Food and Water Watch, and is the author, or at least one of the authors, maybe the entire author, we'll find out in a minute, not sure, of a piece called And the Value of Nothing, Alternatives to Gross Domestic Product and the Financialization of Nature. And Mitch, welcome. Good to have you back with us.
Thanks, Mark.
So this is interesting. The other week we had a conversation on, not soundbites, but on the other part of the Mark Steiner Show, the Mark Steiner Show itself, with the folks from the Institute for Policy Studies who put together the report on GPI. Is that what it's called?
That is what it's called, right? Genuine Progress Indicators.
Which Maryland's using and some other states are using as an alternative to GDP, the gross domestic product, to looking at how our economy is doing. Supposed to be looking at the welfare of not just the wealth of business, but at how it affects education and quality of life and like that. We'll come back to that.
Right.
But this what you're doing fits into that. To talk a bit about the underlying economic philosophy of this paper you wrote. But in the course of that, I'd like you to also explain how you interpret what GDP even means.
All right. Well, I'll start with what GDP means.
Good idea.
So gross domestic product, when I was a kid, gross national product. When you were a kid, gross national product. They changed it about 20-some years ago to gross domestic product, GDP.
Means the same thing, though.
It means basically the same thing. And what it is really just a measurement of the dollar value of goods, services, and products produced in a given period of time. Usually it's for the year. So for instance, 2012 U.S. GDP was upwards of $15.7 trillion. So that's the dollar value of the goods and services produced in the U.S. for the year. And then every quarter, the government does an estimate of the growth or shrinkage of that. And so, you know, every quarter we breathlessly await to find out what happened to the economy. And What that is, you know, we hear, ooh, it grew 4%. Well, what that means is that GDP has grown 4% over the previous year period. And those are all estimates. Those aren't – which is why they get revised. You know, at one point we thought, well, the economy shrunk at the end of 2012. Then they came back and they revised the number, and now we know that it grew by a tiny amount. But that's what it measures. It's the dollar value we put on the production of goods and services, and it doesn't matter – and this kind of gets to this alternatives to GDP point. It doesn't matter whether we're spending money on something good, like, say, the education of our children, or something bad, like sending smoke out of a smokestack, or something remediating what was bad, like having to pay to you know, treat somebody for the cancer that they got because they were living downwind from those smokestacks for the past 30 years. So GDP just measures dollars spent. And there's been a movement.
Public and
all of it. The whole economy.
All of it, right?
The whole economy.
Right.
So, you know, about 45 years ago, roughly, you know, Bobby Kennedy gave this kind of iconic speech at the University of Kansas where he, you know, lamented all of the things that are left out of, at that time, GNP. You know, it doesn't measure the education of our children. It doesn't measure the health of our rivers. It doesn't measure whether or not we're doing a good job as families. And all of the things that are most important to us are left out of GDP. And shortly thereafter, some economists started working on this idea. Ones who went on to win the Nobel Prize, William Nordhaus, Jim Tobin of the Tobin tax, the great idea to tax financial transactions. And they began to develop this process. And where it's evolved over the years is that we've ended up with these alternatives that are attempting to account for all of those things Bobby Kennedy mentioned that we've forgotten, all of those really valuable, most important things that we hold dear, but which don't necessarily have a market value. And that is kind of gets at the crux of the issue here is GDP measures, in essence, market values, something you can put a dollar amount on. What is left out of GDP is everything else. If it doesn't have a market value, it can't be counted in GDP. So the question is, how do we account for that? The system that we have here in Maryland, the GPI that you mentioned, it's being adopted in Vermont. Folks in Oregon have talked about it. People in Oklahoma have talked about it. It's often seen as a progressive thing, but it's being talked about in a variety of places.
And it stands for?
It stands for Genuine Progress Indicators.
Right.
What it does, I contend, is it takes the idea of the market value, so the dollar amount we can put on something like making a car, like producing a radio show, and even a nonprofit one. And it says, and it says, we're going to extend that notion of market value to all of those other things that don't have market values, like the health of our rivers, like the quality of the education of our children, not the dollar, not just the dollar spent, but how good is the education. Meal preparation in the home, which is, you know, nobody denies that making dinner for your kids or for your loved ones is a valuable activity. But is it something that has a market value, or is it something that's valuable because it's me doing something to help my family grow, to be healthy, to be loved? And my contention is that systems, alternatives to GDP like GPI make a mistake when they say the solution is to provide market values for all of these things which have what I would call non-market values. And the real reason for that is, I contend, that part of the problem we have in this country, one of the reasons why we're dealing with so much decay in our inner cities, one of the reasons why we're dealing with so much environmental degradation, no matter where you are, is because we become too wedded to the idea of GDP growth at all costs. We become too wedded to the idea of the market is the answer to every problem that could possibly arise. And so while I agree with the folks who support GPI that GDP doesn't measure the important things, that GDP doesn't tell us how well we're doing as a society, and it was never intended to. Let's be clear on that. Even Simon Kuznets, who developed it initially, said this is not a measure of well-being. It's a measure of economic growth or economic capacity. While we agree on that, what we disagree about is taking the market and extending that over all of these areas where it hasn't already been extended really the solution, or is it just an extension of the problem that we're facing?
So are you arguing that, that when states around the country, like Maryland has done this, where we're broadcasting from,
mm-hmm.
And as you said, Oklahoma, very conservative Republican state.
Yeah, they're looking at it.
They're looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying that GPI, while you think it has some value, or maybe you don't think it has value, we'll talk about that, that what it's doing is taking issues like education, like the Chesapeake Bay in the state of Maryland and
right.
nitrogen phosphorus runoff into
yes.
the rivers from farms, and addressing that, but making creating market solutions, market analysis to make those correct. Is that what the problem is for you?
I think what it does is it extends the market analysis in such a way that it promotes what we call the financialization of nature. And
which means what?
Well, exactly. This is one of those terms that, you know,
because we hear it a lot, but what does it mean?
Yeah, well, it was one of these terms that was invented in you know, this context where nobody ever thought they'd be talking about it on the Mark Steiner show. So what is it? Right? It's a term when you first hear it, you think, oh, that's unfortunate they started to use that. But what it basically is to me, and what I say in the paper that I wrote, is that the financialization of nature at its essence is the replacement of environmental regulation with markets. It's the handing over of nature to the market and saying we're going to let the market figure out how to protect really, you know, next to our children, the most important thing that we have, and maybe not even next to our children, and that is the natural environment in which we live. It's the process of no longer talking about nature but talking about natural capital. It's the process of not talking about
– the GPI makes it natural capital as opposed to nature is what you're saying.
That is – yes. It is dependent upon the notion of natural capital, of taking nature and conceiving of it as capital instead of as nature.
And you live in capitalism.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so people will say to you, well, wait a minute, but – we're talking about our jobs. How am I supposed to get a job if we're not going to say that we want to try to preserve our environment but figure out a way that we can capitalize on it so it can be work for me and for my family and I can eat?
Well, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that if we decide to say, let's take cap and trade as because this is part of the financialization of nature, I would contend – there are people who disagree with me. But I would contend that cap and trade, this idea that what you're going to do is you're going to pay for the right to pollute, which is what cap and trade is. So – say you own a factory and you have a certain amount of pollution.
Right.
Right. I'm going to talk about water cap and trade because this is the most important for us who live here in Maryland because of the Chesapeake Bay. So let's say you're dumping, I don't know, 1,000 pounds of nitrogen into the bay. Now, under the Clean Water Act, you're not supposed to be dumping any. You're supposed to be working to get that down to zero. Right. We all know this. And
I'm not sure we all know.
Well, we don't all know this.
Right. Okay.
Those of us who work in this know this.
Right.
It's probably a revelation for most people that under the Clean Water Act, we're supposed to be getting to zero discharge right. into our waterways. And that's an important point to make to people is that 40 years ago, this past fall, we set as a nation in law the goal of having zero discharge into our waterways. And we have failed. And I would contend that one of the reasons why we failed is because we abandoned that standard and the law that was going to get us there for these market solutions, these pay-to-pollute solutions. So say you've got 1,000 pounds of nitrogen. Let's say your permit that you have with the EPA says you're allowed 500 pounds. Technically, legally, you're supposed to be trying to get rid of that extra 500 pounds. You're supposed to be paying some fines and then working to improve your ability to scrub whatever the source of the pollution is. Under cap and trade, you can go elsewhere and buy the right to have that 500 pounds, whether it's an offset you buy from a farmer, whether it's quote unquote unused pollution from somebody else who's permitted to pollute under the law. This to me doesn't create jobs. This isn't about me being able to put food on the table for my children. What this is about is creating a market in pollution that then the same sorts of financial actors who brought us the financial crisis of 2007, 2008 that we're still living through can get involved. They can sell futures. They can sell all sorts of other options on these credits, on these offsets. It's not about jobs. It's about profit for a very small segment of our economy, the financial actors, the banks, Wall Street. It's not about jobs. What would create jobs is saying, look, we need to figure out a way to actually reduce the amount of pollution that we have in this country. We need to do some research and development. We need to do some testing of products to see how are we going to have energy production that doesn't produce this. How are we going to have water treatment that reduces the amount of nitrogen that comes out of a city sewer system? How are we going to reduce how are we going to be able to help farmers reduce the runoff on their farms or a CAFO clean up its act? That and the investment in that sort of research, that will create jobs. And that, you know, throughout the economy, not just at the research level, but throughout the economy, that money will cycle through and it'll create jobs. And, you know, I really believe that we should be focusing on that. And I'm concerned that the approach that GPI represents takes us away from that. Not intentionally. That's not – I don't – you know, I've met the folks who believe in this, and they're all good people, and they're all trying to work, I think, towards the same sort of goals that I am and that we at Food and Water Watch are. But I think that at the end of the day on this particular issue, it does kind of take us away from that vision of no, especially under the Clean Water Act. It's not as clear anymore under the Clean Air Act. But under the Clean Water Act especially, zero discharge – invest in making the planet cleaner, not in coming up with innovative financial mechanisms to try to pretend that the pollution is no longer a problem. And I'm just concerned that this extension of the market that I talked about a couple of minutes ago promotes that instead of promoting, you know, a really clean, healthy environment.
So if you were to measure things, you're talking more than just measurement here. Right. But if you were to take another way of looking at our life and our economy and our world, other than GDP or GPI,
mm-hmm.
And you focus, so how would that work? I mean, clearly one thing we're talking about is the financialization of nature.
Right.
And what's the alternative there that what we're looking at? And B is what I talked about before we started this conversation
right.
on the air together. Which was to a place like Baltimore City or even Cumberland or Salisbury or wherever that may be. But people cannot figure out a way to create affordable housing so working class people making $40,000 to $80,000 a year can even afford to buy a home
right.
As a family or that people who are living under that, who are living in poverty or near poverty, there is no housing available.
Right.
And so that – those are two real issues that don't get covered in GDP because you're talking about this gross domestic product that says we're growing in this way, we're not
right.
growing in this way, and we're worth X amount of dollars in this country. So what's the alternative?
Well,
and how does it work?
Well, I think, you know, unfortunately, there isn't an easy answer to that question. I think that's one of the reasons why people are enamored with things like GPI, because here we just have another index. It's just another number we can look at and we can chart it. And if you go to Maryland's website, the Maryland government's website, you can look up GPI and they'll have a nice little chart for you and you can look at how GPI has been steady while GDP has been growing. But, you know, there are other measurements that we have to – part of this is we've allowed public policy to become dictated by economics. That's a real problem, I think. There's kind of a dictatorship of economics in public policymaking. And that's why we can't look at things like when you mentioned public housing. Now, Food and Water Watch doesn't work on that issue, but
oh, right, I know you don't. But,
but you know, when you look at that, if you're looking for a solution which says, well, the only way that we can solve this is by incentivizing profit makers to solve the problem, and you're looking for houses that somebody's making $22,000 a year can afford, you're not going to be able to solve the problem, right? So, and that's an economist's way of looking at it. It's saying, how can we get the market, and what I mean by that is how can we get people who are looking to make a profit to solve this problem for us instead of coming together in the one place where we can ideally, and I admit it's far from the real ideal, but ideally come together democratically to solve these decisions, which is our government, where we come together, our representatives come together, and we could try to think these things. We've abdicated. Our government has abdicated that responsibility and said, no, we're going to let the economists try to figure it out. And I think that's a real problem. We can't any longer allow public policy to be dictated just by, well, if we can find a way for somebody to make a profit, this problem's going to fix itself, whether it's public housing, whether it's education and the proliferation of private schooling, whether it's environmental issues, which is where Food and Water Watch works. That can't any longer be the solution that we rely on. It's been failing us now for decades. And I think what the alternative is to take some of those economic indicators. GDP can be reformed so that it's at least a somewhat more accurate reflection of what's going on. You can, you could subtract dollars for what's called negative spending. So, you know, having to clean up for pollution. You can realize that there are some things going on in economic activity that shouldn't be positively counted towards economic growth. You can look at things, I mean, even just taking GDP as it is and looking at it on a per capita basis gives you a somewhat better understanding of what's going on in a country. But of course, if you have the gross economic inequality that we have in this country, that's not really good evidence of what's going on. We have Gini coefficients. Now, that's another economic thing, and it's complicated. But what that measures is inequality, and you can look to see how much inequality there is in a society. But beyond that, and focusing again on the environmental side, we have this you can go online now. If you go to one of the search engines and type in water footprint, you'll get this – you'll get a variety of websites. One of them is run by the Grace Foundation, who Food and Water Watch has a relationship with, and we've helped them develop this. And you can go in and you can figure out, how much water am I and my family using? And you can get this, it's not just your water bill, but it's like, how much does it use because I have this type of shower or that type of washing machine, or because I wash my dishes in the sink as opposed to in a dishwasher? And we can do that on a broader ecological point. And what that shows us is very clearly in this country, we're living well beyond what our, ecological carrying capacity is. We're living well beyond what our water carrying capacity is because, despite the gross inequality in the country and despite the vast amounts of poverty that we have, we are, relative to the rest of the world, a very wealthy society. And we use a lot of natural resources to sustain the way that we live. And you can figure those things out without having to say, okay, well, what's the dollar amount of a given activity in order to know, oh, well, guess what? This is costing us. Well, we know these things are costing us. We don't need to put a dollar figure on it.
So let's bring it back down to the financialization of nature.
Sure.
Financialization of nature.
Right.
And how that plays itself out, literally, when it comes to our land and water.
Yeah.
And how the way we measure things from your perspective doesn't get at the heart of it.
Well, I'll talk about water because that's the one that I actually know best. A couple of years ago, an economist by the name of Willem Buiter, chief economist at Citigroup, did something that I'm sure in hindsight he probably wishes he didn't do, and that is he wrote a little essay on an economist's view of water. And he put out this vision of a global water market modeled on the global oil market or the global wheat market.
Right.
But the key to it was that it was going to be so many times larger than the oil market, the wheat market, the gold market, the copper market, and all the other global resource markets combined. It was going to be the largest resource market for one very simple reason. Although it would be difficult for us to live these days without oil, right now. We're going to have to get there someday. But right now, it would be very difficult to just, stop using it.
Right.
It wouldn't be impossible. If all the oil went away, we could figure out a way to live.
Right, right.
That's not true of water.
Right.
It's not true of air, but it's not true of water either. And that means that if you can figure out a way to create a global market where it's not just water rights like you have in Texas or you have in Australia, although that's problematic, it's actual water in bulk containers being shipped around the globe like oil, and you can find a way for financial actors to then control that, trade it on markets, have water futures, have credit default swaps based on some water future calculation, then what happens is you have a price market for something that is so essential nobody can really go without it for even more than a couple of days at most. You're going to have the price of that, which now those of us who are lucky enough to live in the U.S. by and large can go to the tap and get perfectly drinkable water at, tenths of a penny. We pay for it, but we pay for it in diffuse ways.
It's always been a public commodity.
It's always been a public commodity. Yeah. And, you know, to me, if your society can't provide water for you, that's the most basic thing it needs to provide.
So you're talking about what's happening here is the idea of the privatization of water.
Yes. This would be the privatization of water.
Companies and people who control wealth,
yes,
owning the water the world uses.
Exactly. And I think that these are the first steps in financialization. So you got to privatize whatever the natural resource is. And here it's water. You got to turn it into a commodity. Right. And actually, the bottled water industry plays a really central role in this because it's gotten us all used to thinking of water as something that you buy in a discrete unit.
Right.
You can buy a bottle of it. You can buy a gallon of it. You could have a 5-gallon jug delivered to your office so you don't have to drink the tap water, even though the tap water is perfectly good. You might have to filter it, but it's perfectly drinkable. You know, we in Baltimore have good water. If you can put a filter on, it's good water. So you've privatized it. You've commodified it. You've turned it into a commodity that can be bought and sold. You create a market for that commodity. And here the global vision is this global water market, right? And he really does say, you know, tankers going across the ocean. And he gets all excited because they would only have to be single-hauled, not double-hauled.
Right.
You know, ooh, we're going to save money. And then he says, and once you've done that, then you can financialize it. Now, he doesn't say you can financialize it, but he says you can build the futures markets. You can build all of these other things. And those are the things that those of us who pay attention to food prices and how that impacts food security in low-income communities, we know that that's why, you know, there's a lot of research to show that the Arab Spring was at least in part
wheat prices. Right.
And that's because of a global price, right? Well, if we do that with water, it's just, you know, to me, the idea is unconscionable, which is why I do the work that I do. But that's the vision. That's the financialization of nature, I think, in its rawest, most visceral form and in its most shockingly awful form.
So this is the tip of the iceberg. And I think that we're going to come back to this for all of you and bring some people on to really have added on this and the future of nature and the future of our land, future of our farms and our water and our education systems. And how these all fit together. We've been sitting here talking with Mitch Jones, who's director of the Common Resources Program at Food and Water Watch. The paper we're talking about is called And the Value of Nothing, Alternatives to the Gross Domestic Product and the Financialization of Nature. We will have this posted on our website so you can go to it and read it and other things as well to have this discussion started. And we'll tweet it out there and get it into the world and try to cause a little ruckus and make people think. Mitch Jones, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark. It's always a pleasure.
That's all we have time for today. I'd like to thank all of our guests, Steve Savage, Colin O'Neill, Greg Jaffe, Patty Lavera, and Mitch Jones. The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites on Delmarva is a production of the Center for Emerging Media and made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. For WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.